In celebration of April as National Poetry Month, we will now have a poetry reading by Cynthia. Cynthia is from the seacoast. She's a librarian and an active citizen who believes in the power of words to reach into people's conscience and sense of justice.
This poem is called Draft Dodgers versus Poetry Dodgers by Antler, and it's in Poets Against the War, which was edited by Sam Hamill, published by Thunder's Mouth Press in 2003. Rather than fulfilling their military obligation, fulfilling their poetry obligation. After all, what's more fulfilling, learning how to kill or love? Those who become soldiers are evading the poetry service, dodging the poetry draft. Isn't it their duty to their country more to become a poet than a brainwashed murder robot? When the young contemplate what branch of the service to join, they should know they can contemplate joining poetry, that poetry is a service that serves the realization of utopia more than becoming skilled at killing. Too long it was thought the young were needed to go to war. Now the young are needed to go to peace. Now the young are needed to go to poetry.
Now we have a recorded talk called Facing the Military Machine. Will the draft be reinstated and counter-recruitment efforts? This forum happened last Tuesday at UNH in Durham. The first speaker is Dr. Michael Ferber.
The pressure to have a draft is increasing, but I think there's still very strong pressures against it. And so far, the votes we've had in Congress have been overwhelmingly against it, 410-2 or something. But that could change. I also do not know what is going on in Iraq. I'm comforted by the fact that no one else seems to know what's going on in Iraq, at least no other American seems to. The reporters there say they can't figure out what's going on. They can hardly even leave their compounds. I think what happens in Iraq will bear on whether or not we have a draft. So there are big mysteries.
I actually have something on that. There's a reporter for the Independent of Britain who said that he's in Mosul and he managed to get out some, and that he saw two suicide bombings that never got reported. So there's a lot more attacks happening than we're being told about.
Since the end of the Vietnam War, we've had an all-volunteer army. And it seems to be the universal consensus that this is the way it should be. Talk to top military brass, talk to congressmen, talk to experts, they all say the all-voluntary army has been a success. However, as recently as, well, starting around 2002, there have been some trial balloons being set up. Two conservative Republicans in 2002 actually introduced a bill to bring back the draft. It died in committee. Then in 2003, two left-wing Black Caucus members, Rangel and Conyers, introduced a bill to bring back the draft. And it got two votes or something, or hardly anything. Senator Hollings introduced it in the Senate. Then last year, Senator Hagel, a Republican from Iowa, said that Congress ought to consider a draft. So there are a few voices, both on the left and the right, and even a sort of centrist Republican, are saying things about a draft. And there was an op-ed piece a year ago in the New York Times arguing that the all-volunteer armed forces makes the underprivileged others fight the wars. This was by a former Marine. So there's some grumbling and rumbling out there. More to the point is that towards the end of 2003, which is right when the main phase of the Iraq invasion had stopped and settled, well, just about when they were aware that it wasn't over, just, you know, the mission was not accomplished, and the insurgency was beginning to pick up, Congress allocated $24 million to find draft board members. The draft boards have been basically vacant for some years, but I found conflicting arguments among the bloggers. The usual line has been, there's been nobody on the draft board for years, and now finally we're staffing them. And that would seem to be a real dramatic change. Others have argued that, in fact, draft board members had served for 20 years and are now pretty much all retiring from it. But if you go back 20 years, that doesn't take us to 1975. It only takes us to 1983. So I don't understand that reply. seems to me that the draft board has been essentially vacant for a number of years, if not, and that now suddenly we get money allocated by Congress to find people to sit on it. And they need about 20,000 people, the local boards and the appeal boards, all around the country. I think this is a new development. But there's some argument about just how new it is and whether it was sort of a coincidence, and so on and so forth. I think this is it. They actually now want to have the draft ready to go. Selective Service itself will say on its website that it is our job always to be ready, and the money was just to be ready, but the Congress has not indicated any desire to institute a draft. So they're trying to tell us not to worry, but it's our job to be ready. Still, they seem not to have been ready for over 25 years. So that's an interesting straw in there. Then there's the whole other set of evidence which mounts practically every week, which is the person power shortage, because it's men and women now, in Iraq and in the armed forces generally. Ron, who's in the National Guard, can tell us about how many, you've heard lots of stories, I'm sure, about people going, having their stays extended. The National Guard is practically drained dry, the ready reserve has been drained dry, and they've had to extend the stays, I think, twice now. And early in 2004, 20,000 troops were compelled to stay in the so-called stop-loss policy. At the end of the year, extended another 6,500 soldiers by 2 months, and so on. Now, there's other data. Soldiers are not re-enlisting at the rate that they wish. The Stars and Stripes magazine report of October 2003 said only about half are going to re-enlist. The National Guard is about the same, and I think that's going up.
I can say something about that. The Army has introduced a program where they're giving people like $15,000 bonuses to reenlist. That's how they're addressing that, because it was causing real obvious morale problems, by extending people's stays. Not only people who are over, even if you're part of a unit who, say half the units in Iraq, I mean, you can't, if you're a stateside, you can't get out until they, 6 months after they come back. So not only is it causing problems over people in Iraq, obviously they're unhappy, they're away from their families, but people who don't wish to be in the military anymore, back home. People are, they've had a lot of, problems, and with good reason, because obviously, the Army's been known not to be treating people as good, now it's becoming more and more, obvious, especially since when they first started sending National Guard troops over there, they didn't have the equipment that they needed, and they still, don't.
So it was 15,000 hours now to reenlist in the National Guard?
That's across the board. That's pretty much, I'm not sure, I can't exactly if it's across on Navy, I'm just in the Army Reserve, or National Guard now, I've been in both.
And but what was it 10 years ago? Did they pay you anything?
It depended on your MOS, which is your job in the Army. Mm-hmm. If you're infantry, there's always been a really big bonus, but there's been talks of them increasing the bonus for infantry up to $30,000. But that's after taxes, it comes down to $22,000 or $21,000, mm-hmm. still a lot. But they give you half of it up front, half of it after you complete part of the enlistment, and they will take it back if you don't complete it.
Right. Have to compete with the mercenaries, after all.
These big signing bonuses for enlisting in the regular Army for the first time, that keeps going up. And then the latest news was that in February, the Army missed its recruiting goal by 23%, and in March by 32%. And the Marines also missed their recruiting goal. And the Army Reserve missed by almost 50%.
Not without trying.
That's right, because now there are more recruiters than ever, which I'm sure Vicki will have more to say about. Even Doonesbury has been showing us this.
I collected every single one of them.
It's very funny. It is now recruiter's policy to talk to the parents of possible recruits, because the parents have been a little reluctant in too many cases, so they're trying to soften them up. Doonesbury had very good time, Trudeau had a very good time showing a recruiter talking to, in fact, Doonesbury about getting his daughter. So it seems to me, this evidence seems very clear, that the military forces are in a manpower crisis. It can get worse, but it's pretty bad already. And the reasons for it probably have a lot to do with Iraq, but there's a sort of both senses. People are reluctant to join because of Iraq, but Iraq is also demanding the manpower, the person power. So what does all this mean? Will it mean a draft? I think the people around Bush must be pretty clear in their heads that a draft would be a political disaster. This war is already unpopular. Bush just barely got reelected. There's a lot of opposition to a lot of things. And to suddenly bring in a real draft of the draft of the sort we remember from 34 years ago would be very dangerous. I think they remember that it was the Achilles heel of the Vietnam War, because anti-war movement, used the draft as a great wedge. It was an enormously powerful tool that the drafters had just had. And it caused great political trouble to have young men refusing induction, and court cases, and so on. So I think they don't want it, but I'm beginning to think that the pressure to have it is getting very hard to resist.
The Washington Post had a poll recently saying, was the war in Iraq a mistake? And the majority, I think it was 56%, said yes, it's a mistake. There's been other polls like that. So it's the poll numbers say it's unpopular. They're doing Vietnamization style, trying to do a graceful withdrawal thing, and it didn't work then, it's probably not going to work now. And they're just sort of doing this wishful thinking thing. Everything's going fine, don't worry. Don't report what's really happening. You know, don't worry about it. Maybe we can pretend it's not a problem.
No president wants to face defeat. Now, here's where I just proclaim, I just don't know really what's going on in Iraq. I don't know whether we can just keep 100,000 troops there indefinitely and get our oil, because I think Gulf oil is over there. Or whether it'll get worse, or whether we'll need more or fewer or what, how Iraqization will take place, the armed forces. I think we just don't know. There's lots of conflicting evidence on this. But one thing we do know is that the group around Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and so on have wanted for some time to go into Iran. They made it perfectly clear years ago, before 9/11 and everything. And there have been continual angry remarks about Iran in the last couple of years. I think it is on their long-term agenda to do this. This is not to say Bush has said go ahead, but this is a strong policy current, I think, in the cabinet. I think that's off the table now. I think they can't do it. But I think we could attack from the air. But I don't think we would dare invade. We just haven't got it. We just cannot do it. We're too weak.
Say, if we can't invade Iran, then I would be very doubtful they would even attack it from the air. Because if there's no way to even survey if you hit any of your targets, really, I mean, they do have the satellite photos, but if they're, yeah. I mean, you can't even really do much to a country if you're not going to occupy it. There's just no point.
Well, I thought we might take out the nuclear reactors.
But in that the whole thing with Iraq, it's like these, you know. Yeah. I mean, who knows if he had them or not? He probably didn't, you know. But yeah. Out there, you know, just air, it's, I think we've kind of learned from Iraq that just airstrikes, I mean, just doesn't give you any intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the root of it.
There's been a lot of unmanned aerial vehicles going over Iran, supposedly. And Scott Ritter, I don't know if it's true or not, but he claims that he had some sort of inside scoop that there was like a certain date by which time they were either going to decide to invade Iran or not. June, if they don't capitulate about the nuclear issue, then mm-hmm. they would do it.
This June?
Yeah.
I heard Michael Clare speak here last fall. His book is out called Blood and Oil. He makes a very clear, almost overwhelming case for the looming oil crisis. This is even before the current surge in oil prices. But he said that the most optimistic estimates are that we're going to reach peak production in about 10 years. And we may have reached it already. The oil production will now start to decline, at least the good oil, the sort of pure crude that we pump out of the Persian Gulf area, that kind of oil is going to start diminishing. But the demand for it is going to grow and grow and grow. China alone will see demand. The West demand keeps growing. Our own reserves, our own sources keep diminishing. We now import more than half our oil. In 20 years, we'll be importing 3/4 of it. And from where? So he said, it's pretty clear the Pentagon is taking this into account. It was the Pentagon in the first place during World War II that did the first study of known world oil reserves. It got Franklin Roosevelt to sit down with King Ibn Saud. I mean, our relationship with him goes back to 1944. He said they've been taking stock, and it's clear to them, he says, that the main function of the armed forces in Iraq would be to protect oil, to protect America's oil supplies for the foreseeable future. That is why we already have troops in Colombia protecting the oil pipeline there. There's a battleship off Nigeria. We're putting in bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan already. And we're talking about more around the Caspian. This is essentially what we've been using the military for. And unfortunately, nearly every country that produces a lot of oil is unstable. He's thinking we're going to be stuck in country after country to guarantee our oil supply.
Funniest part of that is the one country that's the most stable, perhaps, of the oil producers the U.S. has been trying to destabilize, that being Venezuela. There was a U.S. supported, perhaps not proven, but backed coup attempts a little while ago.
That's right. We're going to have a steady, fairly large armed forces all over the world, smallish but many bases, highly mobile things, ships and so on. So we're going to need a lot of people. But we're also going to need them, especially in the Persian Gulf, because that's still the prime source. And the other thought was, okay, supposing we don't want the U.S. to invade Iran, we want to make sure that we don't have any more of these wars, what should we be doing? My first thought is simply that we should be announcing now the sort of thing, well, of course, Vicky's going to talk about counter-recruitment, and that's important. But I think we should be making clear now that if there's a draft, we'll resist it. When I say we, I'm, of course, too old for it. But I think anyone, male or female, 18 to 20s, 30s,
Right now, the age, I think
went from 34
to 36.
Yeah, they just
We don't know when they'll start, what age they'll choose. There's some talk about starting at an older age than they did, say, during Vietnam. Instead of 18, it might be 21 or 2 because they want better trained people, whatever it is. I think it would be really good to see what we saw in 1966, 67, 68, which were we-won't go statements. Now, at that time, there was a draft. But young men were signing statements saying, if I am drafted, I will not serve.
And that'd be women, too.
And now it could include women, just as readily, in the statement.
You know, there are people who can go through the military and everything that was promised to them is going to be given to them. I don't want to stand here and say that, like, none of that happens. But I think there's a lot of misperception. We watched the commercial. The Air Force yesterday had an ad that the first part of it is people snowboarding all through this place. Has anyone seen this one?
Yes.
It's the first time I had seen this one, but it's just snowboarding. It's like a really cool commercial. It's like, oh, I want to go snowboarding. And then this guy pulls out his global positioning unit, and it's like, they're like, oh, we're lost. You know, and they're like, we're looking for you. You know, it's adventure. The big part of it, though, is money for college. One-third of people who sign for the military do it solely for the money that they can get for college. It's the only reason that they're signing up for it. You know, college is not cheap. I'm in debt right now and will be for many, many years. So I'm like in debt, and I can understand why people would want to sign up. The important thing to pay attention to is that our parents spoke about the GI Bill, and the GI Bill was something that, you know, really funded people who were serving in the military. They got to go to college and pretty much for free. Right now, we have what's called the Montgomery GI Bill, which is different. Of the people who sign up to get money for college, you first of all have to give $1,200 into the program to sign into the program. Basically, you have to make the decision during like your first couple, 2 weeks of training, whether you'd like to sign up to the program or not. And it's money taken out of your salary right there. It's not like you hand them a check, but it's money taken out of your salary. And this is during like basic training that you have to make the decision.
The recruiter pretty much will talk everybody into doing that. Even before you get to your first 2 weeks of training, you have an option to sign it. And they'd be like, look, you know, are you going to turn down, you know, $50,000, $100,000 for college? So that's like not even, nobody even really gets asked that question.
Okay. Of all the people who sign on for money for college, 65% of those people will never see a penny for college. So, I mean, that's a glaring majority. It's not just saying, like, some people won't get money. And that's no money. I'm not saying they don't get all of it. They don't get any money. Of the people who get the money, that 35% who do get money, the average amount is $35,000.
That's really insidious for people who are in the National Guard. That's what I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And they give you some money up front. I mean, I still have all kinds of student loans. It's not really barely enough to even cover your housing. But they have what's called a tuition repayment program, and that only starts on your student loans. There's like a usually 3 to 4 years after you join the National Guard. But they, you know, a lot of soldiers are uninformed. I was uninformed about it. You have to send them a letter, tell them when to start. Essentially, most people who are in my position get, you know, this aid coming in from the government when, you know, they're out of college and they've only got 1 year left for the National Guard or, you know, the Reserve. You start sign up with what's called the 6x2, where you do 6 years in the National Guard Reserve and then 2 years in active reserve, where up until now, it was pretty much considered being out. You know, I'm one of the people who got called back in with the, you know, inactive reserve. I was already done my 6 years. But you can't get them even half the money unless you re-enlist, because once you're out, even though you're promised the money, they stop paying you, you know, your student loans off. Because a big part of it is they'll pay back they say $10,000 worth of student loans, which still isn't much, but usually it ends up being around four or five, because they do it in very small increments. You'd have to stay in the Army for 20 years, really, almost, to get it all.
Not everyone is going to be honorably discharged from the military, and right off the bat, you don't get any money unless you get that honorable discharge. In addition to that, there are certain tasks that you have to fulfill during your time while you're serving. First of all, you do have to have 4 years of active duty, which gets in trouble when you start doing reserves. Unfortunately, the military has also gotten a lot trickier, especially with active duty, where in some cases people are getting like this decision of, because of the extra 6 months that they can keep people on, there's a lot of kind of finagling with people of, you've got 3 months left of your 4 years, and at this point, you can either leave the military early, or you can re-enlist and go over, you can either leave the military early, or they'll have you re-enlist into the military again, or they're going to send you over to Iraq for an additional 6 months. They'll send you over at that time left. With that decision to make, you're either, first of all, going over for a longer time, which for some people, if they've been over to Iraq enough, it's not really this great decision, and it's not something they want to do. Leaving 3 months early, being able to get on with everything sounds great. If you leave 3 months early, you have not finished your full active duty time, and as a result, you're not going to get your money for college.
I have a lot of experience with all kinds of recruiters. Yeah. And, at heart, they're people, they're good people.
Exactly.
But the military has designed, it's like a system where, anybody who wants to make a career out of the military, and most recruiters are, at least a staff sergeant or higher, which is someone who's been in the military for at least, unless they're a real, they get ranked very quickly. They've probably been in for at least 8 or 9 years, 7 to 9 years already. So the military has a system where just about anybody who wants to stay in the military for 20 years or maybe become an officer or gain, the rank of like sergeant major or a high rank has to have a successful recruiting tour. And if they don't, they're not going to get promoted, because the thing is, this guy, goes to be a recruiter, even help recruiting, doesn't become a non-commissioned officer. If you don't perform recruiting, then your military career is dead, or you've got to go through another cycle. And nobody likes recruiting because of the long hours, So, it turns recruiters into really insidious people. And again, it's not their fault. But, anybody who's in the military will tell you the one person you can't trust is a recruiter. There are people that showed up to base training where I went with their wife and kids, because the recruiters told them they would house them, which is not anywhere near any kind of truth. There are people who showed up, like, oh, yeah, can I take my TV? Sure. The recruiters would tell the kids anything, as long as they didn't get them in writing. It couldn't be proven. They would tell them anything to get them there. And I've been, duped by recruiters on several occasions. I was told last spring I was going to be deployed to Afghanistan. And I was in the inactive reserve, or the ready reserve, so I was out. I had a job. I wasn't even in school. And so I got a call from a guy who wasn't even a recruiter, actually. He was working with a recruiter, but he was a sergeant first sergeant in a company of drill sergeants. And essentially, they said, okay, you're going to be deployed to Afghanistan. Either that, or you can stick around, and join our drill sergeant company. Drill sergeants haven't been deployed overseas in two wars, So I was like, okay, that sounds pretty good. Then our unit got put on alert to go to Iraq after like a week after I got in, and I got sucked into the stop loss, so I couldn't get out when I was supposed to. So that whole cycle just continued.
The enlistment agreement says, first of all, there's in the event of war, my enlistment in the armed forces continues until 6 months after the war ends, unless my enlistment is ended sooner by the President of the United States. This is stop loss right here. So it's things like that. The other really important part to pay attention to, which, for someone who's 18, doesn't know really what to look for in a contract, would not look for, is laws and regulations that govern military personnel may change without notice to me. Such changes may affect my status, pay, allowances, benefits, and responsibilities as a member of the armed forces, regardless of the provisions of this re-enlistment document. That means even in this part where they say any promises have been made, it doesn't matter, because that start part right there has told me it doesn't matter what's written here. I could be a member of the military band, or have been told that I could just be a band member the whole time. Well, they have enough trumpeters, so you're going to go into infantry. They can change really anything, and that's an important, section C, number 9, 5B. Okay, so, like, I didn't find it really easily. It's all the way kind of tucked in there. And if we really want to call ourselves having an all-volunteer military, well, I don't think it's all-volunteer when we have agreements like this, when people are signing away and saying, this is what I'm volunteering for, and they get there, and it's not what they volunteered for at all. You were not signed in. Apparently, like, when you get to the base where basic training is, there are, like, these footprints that you step in, and they're, like, yellow prints. And I don't know. We've seen them all, like, I don't know. You know, they're just, like, painted in there. And until you stand there and take the, and say the oath aloud, you're not in the military. So if you don't even do that, then you're not in, even if you take the bus. So letting people know that information is really important.
Well, the more people know about it, even just a few of us here, the better, because it's just information.
It means information that you guys especially can bring back to your high school.
But you still have to register for Selective Service if you want to go to university.
What I
right
did
now,
is I just, I finally, when they sent me a letter threatening me, I finally said, all right, I'm registering. Here's a letter included with it basically saying I will not serve.
There are a lot of people out there who aren't signing up, and they're really not going after people right now. You know, I know they say there's penalties and jail sentences and stuff, but there's really nobody out there. I wish, I don't have those numbers on me because I didn't do any of my conscious objector, but basically there's like there's a huge number of people who aren't signing up for Selective Service, and I believe in the past 10 years two people have been arrested for it. You know, it's making an example, I guess, but there's really not the penalty unless you want money for school.
They just opened a National Guard offices in Durham and Keene.
They're not open until the fall.
And what the announcement was, a statement that it's not really to it's not because there's a college university town. There are other reasons, and it kind of what you wonder what the other reasons might be.
There are towns that have truth ordinances that, in order to be doing the work, you have to be providing truthful information. So you could say, yeah, you can get money for college, but. You can only get some. So in those cases, unfortunately, because of the model that's set up for how recruiters are trained right now, that's meaning recruiters aren't there at all. But so those are things that towns can do as well, is setting up, if you have a recruiter coming in, setting up a truth ordinance and saying, salesmen aren't allowed to, you know, there are certain laws about what a salesman can tell you, and, you know, you can't be selling things based on all these lies.
These are all local ordinances?
Local ordinances, yeah. Have you guys ever heard of PNAC, People for a New American Century? It's a group with, let's see, Bush Sr., Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, who's the old trade ambassador? Zolick. A lot of, like, influential international policy people in Bush's staff are members of People for a New American Century. And this is supposedly a nonpartisan special interest group that looks at foreign policy. And they were ones who said that in order to invade Iraq, there had to be some form of Pearl Harbor-esque tragedy to convince people to go over. This was something that was stated in 2000. So. It's an influential group, not saying that they influence that, but they knew the kind of thing that it would take in order, you know, and they knew that they could go back into Iraq with something like that going on. This group has, in February, they came out with a statement that never used the term draft, but they talked about the need to go into other countries. In particular, they did talk about Iran and Syria. But they also talked about the need for constant troops, and that the need for troops is up, and that we need to keep getting troops, and we need to use new methods in order to get these troops.
The draft is coming. It's blowing down the door, so pack your bags, boys and girls. We're all going off to war. You can be the next to die for Halliburton. Pull the cord, drape the flag, and draw the curtain. You can pull the trigger for the Exxon Corporation. Watch the cities burn around you while you're standing at your station. You can shoot the children as they throw stones at your Humvee. You can die for Kerry or maybe for Dick Cheney. The draft is coming. It's blowing down the door, so pack your bags, boys and girls. We're all going off to war. When your tours are over and you come back, maybe you can go to college if you survived Iraq. With dew dust in your lungs, you can learn a trade. In your dying years, you'll have it made. When you're coughing up your last breath beneath the overpass, you'll be praying for the fortunes of the military brass. The draft is coming. It's blowing down the door, so pack your bags, boys and girls. We're all going off to war. But you can be proud about the cause for which you died. At least you fought for freedom, unlike the other side. They were setting off car bombs while you dropped them from the sky. You sold the country off to whatever company would buy. Shut their papers down and shot them for their liberty. So as you die, you know you left the world just a bit more free. The draft is coming. It's blowing down the door, so pack your bags, boys and girls. We're all going off to war. History repeat. Fight for empire in the desert and go down in defeat. Or maybe it could happen that now in the second round we will take the struggle higher and this time hear the sound of the chimes of freedom ringing when we take Washington D.C. Cause opportunity is knocking. Oh, say, can you see the draft is coming?
That was David Rovics with The Draft is Coming.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Virginia Sacchetti of the South African Anti-Privatization Forum, who criticizes the World Bank and International Monetary Fund's policies toward impoverished nations. Terry Jones, a founding member of the Monty Python comedy troupe, who explains why he believes that policies followed by President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair in the War on Terror have made the world a more dangerous place. And Sister Helen Prejean, one of the country's most passionate opponents of the death penalty, who recounts how she came to be a leader of the national campaign to abolish capital punishment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In October 2004, Washington, D.C. District Court Judge Emmett G. Sullivan, in response to a lawsuit filed by six John Doe soldiers, effectively banned the anthrax vaccine immunization program, stating the process that allowed the required vaccine to be licensed in the first place was unlawful. However, in December, the Pentagon obtained an emergency authorization to resume the vaccine program for military personnel on a voluntary basis. This was the first time a provision of the Project BioShield Act, a law passed 3 years after the 9/11 attacks, had been invoked. Since early April, Judge Sullivan had allowed the Pentagon to continue the vaccine program on the condition that it must remain voluntary. The anthrax vaccination program, mandatory since 1998, has administered inoculations to 1.1 million soldiers in a six-shot anti-anthrax regimen for protection against the so-called inhalation anthrax. Hundreds of soldiers who refused the vaccine have been kicked out of the military. Navy veteran Jesse Kearns received the vaccine in 2000 as part of his deployment to the Persian Gulf. Since then, 25-year-old Kearns has suffered two heart attacks, blood clots, and a stroke that has left him with a limp. A Long Island resident, Kearns must now get by on $300 a month in disability pay. According to the Village Voice, Critics charge that the side effects of the vaccine can be severe, including death, and the number of soldiers who have become ill is significant. The 15-year career of Arizona Sheriff Samuel Powers ended the day he was shot during a training exercise with the M26 Taser, a stun gun with 50,000 volts of electricity. The so-called non-lethal stun gun is growing in popularity with many police departments, with as many as 100,000 police officers carrying tasers. Yet, increasingly, some law enforcement professionals worry about the unknown risks of the high-powered stun gun made by Arizona-based Taser International. During the Taser exercise, Powers fell over in intense pain as the weapon's electrodes were attached to his shoulder and ankle. He was struggling to breathe with massive pain in his back and chest. As he recalled, "It was the worst pain I felt in my life." According to Amnesty International, over 90 people in the US and Canada have died after being shot with a taser, mostly due to complications from heart attacks, drug intoxication, or asphyxiation. In 80% of the cases, the suspect was not armed, and in a third of the cases, police used the stun gun to control verbal compliance. Amnesty International has called for a moratorium on the use of the taser, citing the lack of independent research on the stun gun and the health impact of its increased use. Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, a prospective 2008 presidential contender, has merged his operations with the powerful Texas law firm Bracewell & Patterson, who have strong ties with the energy industry and the Bush White House. The new law firm, Bracewell & Giuliani, has a blue-chip client list that includes Enron, ExxonMobil, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Dynegy. It has also represented major firms in healthcare, telecommunications, and emerging technology. Over the years, the law firm's reputation has been made defending the most powerful corporations in the energy industry. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, Giuliani will open the firm's first New York office. In recent years, the former mayor, through his consulting company, Giuliani Partners, has worked for Entergy Nuclear Northeast to beef up security at New York area nuclear power plants, and for TransCanada and Shell to create support for building a liquefied natural gas facility on Long Island Sound, a project bitterly opposed by conservationists. Many environmentalists say the move by Giuliani to team up with Texas energy interests is designed to help him raise the millions of dollars he needs for the 2008 presidential campaign. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Five years ago, tens of thousands of demonstrators staged militant protests in Washington, D.C. to oppose the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund toward impoverished nations while demanding the cancellation of crippling debt. Although the giant financial institutions have adopted some of the rhetoric of global social justice activists in the intervening years, they have not altered their neoliberal economic model of privatization and free trade. While fewer in number, protesters in Washington again this year expressed anger and dissatisfaction with the bank's policies, sentiments shared by millions in the developing world. During their spring meeting in Washington, delegates to the World Bank and IMF failed to reach agreement on canceling the debt of poor countries and increasing aid directed toward their people. Among those inside and outside the World Bank, there is growing concern that the goal established 5 years ago to reduce global poverty by 2015 could be undermined by right-wing ideologue and Iraq War architect Paul Wolfowitz, named by President Bush to become the bank's next president. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Virginia Setshedi of the Anti-Privatization Forum based in Johannesburg, South Africa, a group that assists poor residents in Soweto to restore water and electricity service shut off by private utilities. Setshedi, who was in Washington to speak out during the meetings, explains why she is critical of World Bank IMF development policies and her concern about the bank's future under the direction of its new president, Paul Wolfowitz.
Aid comes with lots of, problems, and the developing countries tend to use aid as a tool of dominating the underdeveloped countries. So our call is for the banks to cancel the debt, and because most of the money that are supposed to be taking care of our people in our countries are being taken to pay this debt that doesn't end. Most of the countries are being forced to pay the illegitimate debt. Where, for instance, in South Africa, as you know, we had apartheid for many years, and the apartheid government took these loans, and the money that was taken from these loans was used into buying arms and bullets to kill our people. And now the call that we're making in our country is that this debt is a legitimate or it's an odious debt. Therefore, our countries are not supposed to pay. So those things have never been spoken about in this meeting.
What is the obstacle, in your view, to making a decision among these wealthy nations to eliminate the debt that really creates huge problems in terms of just basic social welfare and the nations that must pay these debts back?
I think it goes back to the nature of the bank itself or the financial institutions. What are they for? Are they still performing what they were initially established for? And in what context are they operating? And it has been clear that they are operating in the context of neoliberal paradigm, which forces countries to follow this trend, which is enforcing, you know, the capitalist principles and making sure that the poorer gets poorer and the richer gets richer, and which is the case with the countries as well. You know, we see poor countries becoming more poor and while rich countries are becoming richer.
Virginia, what's the role of the United States and the Bush administration, in your view, for eliminating the debt on the poorest countries as well as increasing the aid? The United States really stands at the lowest level in terms of a percentage of its GDP that it devotes to assisting poor nations.
I think, you know, the role of the United States has been a negative role, and we see it especially in, like when Bush visited our country, Africa, last year. You know, he didn't say anything about issues around debt, but he said something about AIDS, but it's not, also not clear how is he going on with it. But also sort of using our president, especially President Mbeki, to be his instrument to enforce his imperialist ideas around Africa. And he even said, you know, Thabo Mbeki is my point man in Africa, so he is a boy that he's confident that he's doing his job in Africa.
Virginia, what are some of your concerns about the installation of Paul Wolfowitz, an architect of the Iraq War, formerly Deputy Defense Secretary of the Pentagon? What's your concern about what he'll do as president of the World Bank?
No, my minor concerns will be, does he know anything about development? Because, I mean, the bank is a development bank. But also, for me, his nomination, you know, brings a very good opportunity, especially for us in the social movement and in the anti-war movement, to show that there's no difference between war and imperialism and the World Bank itself. And Wolfowitz, you know, as we know, his background in the Pentagon now will play the role that he played before within the bank. And then what we need as social movements and is to sort of like link these issues and make our struggle strong in making sure that we deal with issues around war, imperialism, and development, and poverty, and so forth.
Maybe you could briefly state what you think that link is between the operations of the World Bank, the neoliberal economic policies, and the unilateral military policies of the Bush administration.
You know, like after the war in Iraq, those contracts that companies like Halliburton got in Iraq, and those contracts were sort of like pushed by Wolfowitz himself. And now the World Bank will also play a role in making sure that those contracts are being enforced, and it's not going to only be in Iraq and, you know, all over the world if possible. And Wolfowitz, as someone who can make decisions like invasion of Iraq, can also, you know, make decisions around how to deal with poverty, but we don't think that his decisions on dealing with poverty in the third world will be what we're looking for as activists in those countries, because he'll be sort of like enforcing the Bush administration ideas and the principles around dominating these third world countries.
That was Virginia Setshetty of the Anti-Privatization Forum, based in Johannesburg, South Africa. She also serves on the board of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network at area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. Visit the Anti-Privatization Forum's website at www.apf.org.za. As the daily attacks on U.S. forces and their allies in Iraq step up after a post-election lull, increasing numbers of citizens are becoming skeptical of a White House forecast for stability and a reduction in the number of American troops in the occupied nation. With suicide bombings and kidnappings an almost daily occurrence, few Western journalists dare to venture very far from their hotels in the green security zone in Baghdad to report on the war. And as the U.S. military switches from offensive operations to training members of the Iraqi police and military, insurgents have also changed their tactics, targeting and killing large numbers of these forces. The situation for civilians has also continued to deteriorate. The United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva recently reported that the number of Iraqi children suffering from malnutrition has doubled since the U.S. invasion toppled the government of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Terry Jones, one of the founding members of the Monty Python comedy troupe, has since September 11th been writing columns in the British press highly critical of George Bush and Tony Blair's militaristic policies in the Middle East. His essays, laced with irony and humor, have now been published in the U.S. under the title Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, Observations and Denunciations by a Founding Member of Monty Python. Reached by phone in London, Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with Jones about why he feels that the Bush-Blair policies have made the world a more dangerous place.
You know, after 9/11, it seemed like our great leaders said all the right things, but did all the absolutely the wrong things. It seemed like, you know, every action they took seemed to be guaranteed to have the opposite result of what they said it was going to have. And they just did, I mean, like, for example, Tony Blair saying he's going to make England safe from terrorist attack. Well, England wasn't under any terrorist threat. The IRA had stopped bombing us. We didn't have any. There wasn't any reason to be scared of Muslim fundamentalists. We got along with the Islamic people in England fine. There was no threat. The only threat came when he started joining America and bombing a country that had never even threatened us. That was what was so one of the things that was so baffling. But I mean, like after 9/11, for example, I mean, George Bush, you know, said all the right things. He said, well, we've got to catch the evil perpetrators of this evil deed. So I guess what you would do in that case is you'd rely on secrecy and speed and catch them by surprise. What you don't do is announce where you're going to look for them. We're going to look for you in Afghanistan. When are you going to do it? In 2 weeks' time. And then what are you going to do to them? We're going to bomb you. I mean, like in 2 weeks' time, there's not going to be a single perpetrator of an evil deed left in Afghanistan. They're not going to catch, it's like playing hide and seek, not like catching a criminal.
So all the things they did, you think will backfire on this country and your nation, Britain?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I mean, even Tony Blair's advisors in the Foreign Office were telling him that to actually join American bombing Iraq would put England on the front line of a terrorist attack and make it a target rather than the reverse, which is what Blair is. I mean, it's so stark, staring, obvious that it's amazing. It has to be spelled out. I kind of feel a lot with the columns I was writing that I was just saying the obvious, really. And it seems funny when you say the obvious, but, you know, the press isn't saying it.
What's the view of George W. Bush in Great Britain?
I don't know. I can't really speak for everybody. I mean, I can give you my opinion, which is that I'm sure George Bush is a very, you know, very companionable guy, you know, somebody you'd get on well with, you know, behind the locker rooms and having a quiet fag with him after school, you know, things like that. But I don't think it's him that's running the country. I think he's just a very pliable figurehead for Cheney, Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, all those shadowy figures who populate the White House and the Pentagon now, and who are running the show, basically, and they're calling the tunes. And I think those are the sinister characters.
You have an election coming up in Britain. What are the prospects for Tony Blair, and how much of his policies on Iraq and alliance with George W. Bush, how much negativity do you think is going to accrue to him in the polls for his decisions?
Well, I think there's a lot of negativity in thinking people and in sort of intelligent people and intelligent members of the Labour Party. I think there's a big resentment there, and I think a lot of people who will just not vote for him. I mean, speaking personally, I will just not vote for the man. And I think his credibility as a truthful statesman has been totally undermined by the pack of lies he told and the spin he gave to the dodgy dossier and to stampeding people into believing that we had to bomb Iraq, that Iraq was a threat. I think he's lost a lot of credibility there. And I think one can see how much he knows he's lost by the fact that he tries to ignore it. He doesn't want to talk about Iraq. Oh, that's all over and done with. You know, the Labour Party are desperate to try and put other things on the agenda. And, of course, the press is very complacent and compliant and talks about other things rather than I think what is the key thing, the fact that he took our country to war on false pretenses. And a lot of people, 100,000 Iraqis, have died as a result of it. And I think it's an absolute abomination.
Terry Jones, in conclusion here, certainly the landscape of the world, our two nations, Britain and the United States, is quite bleak these days. Do you take some hope that there'll be some change in the near to not to distant future in terms of our politics, in terms of our foreign policies, in terms of making an effort for peace in the world?
Yeah, I think the only hope is with you, really, with the American public, waking up to the true nature of the guys who are running the show at the moment and the true nature of the Rumsfeld and Cheney and Pearl and Wolfowitz. It's only when, you know, the word gets around about who they are and what they're up to, and it's up to the American public to actually get them out of office and get the more reasonable set of people in power. It's going to be a tough one, but I hope they can do it. But I hope it happens. But I think the ball's in your court.
That was Terry Jones, columnist, author, and founding member of the Monty Python comedy troupe. His latest book, Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, is published by Nation Books. Sister Helen Prejean is one of the country's best-known and most passionate opponents of the death penalty. She has been speaking out since the early 1980s, when she accompanied convicted murderer Patrick Saunier to his execution by electrocution. She wrote the book Dead Man Walking about her experience, which later became an Academy Award-winning movie with Susan Sarandon playing Prejean in the leading role. Sister Prejean spoke earlier this month at Yale University's Catholic Chapel, where she made reference to Connecticut's death penalty law, which was recently challenged and debated in the state legislature, though the law authorizing execution by lethal injection was not abolished. Serial rapist and murderer Michael Ross will be executed in Connecticut on May 11th, unless a federal judge rules in the next few weeks that he was incompetent to waive his remaining appeals and choose to die. This would mark the first execution in all of New England in 45 years. Sister Prejean's talk at Yale followed a recent report in Britain's top medical journal, The Lancet, which argued that some prisoners executed by lethal injection may feel extreme pain because they are improperly sedated as they are put to death.
When I came out of the execution chamber on the night of April the 5th, 1984, I had just watched a man be put to death in front of my eyes. Patrick Saunier. I had been asked to write letters to him when I began working among people in the inner city, and I really thought all I was ever going to do would be to write letters. So much for the sneakiness of God, part one. I never dreamed Louisiana was going to kill him. It was 1982. We hadn't killed anyone since the 60s. The whole country had had a moratorium on the death penalty. I thought I was only going to be writing letters. And then I accompanied him and found myself, as he said to me right before, and he was to be electrocuted to death in the electric chair, saying to me, "No, Sister Helen, you can't be there at the end because it could scar you psychologically to see this. Just pray that God holds up my legs." And I found myself saying to him, "No, Pat, there's no way you're going to die alone without a loving face to see. You look at me, and I will be the face of love. I'll be the face of Christ for you." And right before they put the mask on him, the mask when they electrocute someone is to protect the witnesses so they can't see what happens to a human face when 1,900 volts of electricity would be passed through his body. He caught my eye there with the witnesses, and I carry his face inside of me. I walked out, it was the middle of the night, having just watched someone who was alive, who was talking to me, and then who was walked down the hall and was killed. And I threw up, and I remember thinking it was dark. The polls in Louisiana said everybody thought the death penalty was a fine idea. I had been drawn in as a witness, and I remember thinking, you know, the people of Louisiana are never going to see this. It's almost a secret ritual. And I thought that at that moment, and I've followed it ever since, I got to tell the story. I've been the witness. I got to be the one to bring people close to this and to talk about the death penalty. And I began to do that right after. If you put me on Google, I'm known as a death penalty nun. That's how you draw me up on Google. Real Christianity stretches us. Cultural Christianity, Christianity light, you don't have to be stretched. Just say an eye for an eye and you're in there with all the rest and for the death penalty, right? You don't have to reflect, you don't have to dig, you don't have to deal with this huge ambivalence that most of us struggle with over the death penalty. The outrage over the death of innocent people that we hear about, and then the part of our hearts that knows you can barely trust the government to fill the potholes right, much less have a system whereby we're going to select who lives and who dies in our state. Please. I mean, the only reason you in Connecticut are faced with the death penalty is because you have somebody that wants the state to help him end his own life because he's had enough of it. To think that we have come to a point in this society that we actually say, and the language of the Supreme Court of the United States when they put the death penalty back in the Gregg decision has language that says executions are not against the dignity of the human person, even though life imprisonment is available. And there are some crimes so morally outrageous that only death will suffice. What kind of language is that? To have politicians or to have prosecutors say to the victims' families who are undergoing grief and confusion and loss and outrage, "We're going to heal you. We're going to offer you something in this society now. We're going to go for the death penalty because that's the only way we really show honor and respect for your dead loved one." The way, and you hear language sometimes at trial, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we so respect life in this society. And look, this poor woman has been killed. Look, her parents are sitting there. Look at their grief. They'll never see their daughter graduate from college. They'll never see the grandchildren. The way that we show respect for life, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is I want you to ask you to stiffen your backbone, bite the bullet, and do the tough thing, which is to give the death penalty, and then to promise to the victim's family." Now you wait 10, 15, 17 years, and we'll summon you one day, and you come sit on the front row, and you watch as we kill the one who killed your loved one, and that will heal your heart. That will give dignity to your loved one who has been lost. That will honor their life. And people like murder victims' families for reconciliation, for human rights in this country, stand before us. They come to judicial hearings at state legislatures, and they say, "Don't kill for me. Don't say we're going to honor the life of my loved one by now you, the state, going through this protocol, premeditated death of a human being."
That was death penalty opponent Sister Helen Prejean speaking at Yale University in early April. For more information on the nun's campaign against the death penalty, call area code 504-948-6557 or visit her website at www.prejean.org. Prejean's talk was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for joining us for Making Waves. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show or let us know that you want to help. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com/radio. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and needs your membership and participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be further exploring issues around in the environment and the earth. We leave you with this quote. When the sun rises, I go to work. When the sun goes down, I take my rest. I dig the well from which I drink. I farm the soil that yields my food. I share the creation. Kings can do no more. That's from China, 2500 BCE.